This interview is being conducted on December 23rd, 2006 at the Indian Prairie Library in Darien, Illinois. My name is Kevin Haney. I am speaking with Lawrence DeWitt Smith. Mr. Smith was born October 6, 1968 in Oak Lawn, Illinois, and now lives in Downers Grove, Illinois. He is currently employed as a commercial truck driver and has kindly consented to be interviewed for the project. He heard about the project through the Indian Prairie Library. And now this is Mr. Smith's story. Pertaining to entering the military, where were you living at the time when you entered the service, and what were you doing there at that time?
I lived in Palm Springs, California, which is in Southern California, and I was a high school student, and I enlisted in the latter part of the summer of 1986 in September.
Why did you pick the service branch you joined?
Be honest, I wanted to serve my country, and I thought the Army was the one my best choice.
Okay. And what were the first few days like?
Repeat the question.
The first few days, I mean, kind of walk us through the enlistment process and training and that sort of thing.
You mean before I went in?
No, right at the time when you enlisted and then
in January of 1986, it happened to be the day that the space shuttle blew up.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I took my Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test, the ASVAB, and it was in Indio, California. I was 17 when I enlisted, and I just took the test. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do yet, and then I made a decision after I graduated high school, and I believe I signed up in August, and I left in September. And I went through the military interesting processing station in Los Angeles. And when I was there, I took two trips. I had to do my physical interviews. I believe we had to do drug tests. And my recruiters were straightforward with me. Mm-hmm. And my MOS was 63 Hotel, track vehicle repairman. And
now, what does MOS mean?
The military occupational specialty.
Okay.
And since I was a minor, I couldn't sign up on my own. So after I went up there and to the MET station in Los Angeles, I came back home and I talked over with my mom again. And then a few days later, all the paperwork was about, and the recruiter came to my house, and my mom had to give consent. And then took it from there, and I had my date was, I believe, in towards the latter part of September. I left for Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. But one thing that was kind of funny is I could have left earlier, but my parents divorced in 1971, and they needed to have evidence that my parents were divorced for some reason. The government needed that. So my mom didn't have the divorce papers, so we had to send back to Illinois, to Cook County. My dad had to get all that. It was kind of a process. Nobody could find them. Oh. And that kind of delayed me from going a little bit. And my dad had to do some kind of paperwork. And when he was doing that, he accidentally used blue ink instead of black ink and required, so we had to redo the whole process again.
Okay.
And then the day I left, we left out of Los Angeles International Airport. I stayed at a hotel in L.A. with other new soldiers, and we left in late afternoon and got to Fort Jackson, South Carolina. It was around midnight because we stopped, I believe, in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And continue?
Yeah, how long was basic training about?
Well, basic training, the entire time I was there was a little bit over 9 weeks. The night we got there for the first week was all in processing, and we did detail work, and then We went through 8 weeks of training. They tried to push it a little bit because we got out, graduated the day before Thanksgiving, I believe it was. Because, yeah, it was actually it was a Tuesday, and then Wednesday we left to go to my advanced interview training, AIT, in Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland.
Okay, so what sort of things was the initial stage of basic training? Now, that would be like a general basic training that everybody goes through regardless of their specialty.
Yeah, well, for the Army, you know, you're learning basic soldiering infantry skills. Everything from first aid to becoming a marksman, setting up a Claymore mine, uniforms, inspections, a lot of marching, you know, discipline, being screamed and yelled at, all the things that a soldier needs.
Okay. And what was sort of the kind of conversation and the morale amongst the guys in basic training?
I'd say morale was pretty good because when I went in, it was at peacetime. Everybody there was a volunteer. There was no draft. You had some people that had, I was 17, you know, I didn't know anything about the world. Some people had been out in the world. We had every form of life. Some people had bad attitudes. I grew up in a resort town. We were upper middle class where a lot of guys came from the inner cities and this was their way out. And some were glad to be there, some weren't, but they all volunteered, so it was mixed.
Okay. And what do you remember about your instructors?
Well, I remember I had the two drill sergeants I had in base training was Drill Sergeant Matthews. He was our senior drill sergeant. And then we had Drill Sergeant Ward, he was assistant. And these guys were very hard on us, but they were fair. And they were very committed to their job. And I could see why, because to become a drill sergeant in the military, they go through a school that's probably worse than basic training. And these guys gave it their all. They were clear and to the point. They didn't take no bull or anything like that. And they put a lot of emphasis on the buddy system, like taking care of your fellow soldiers. A lot of emphasis when I was in the military on that, all through my career.
Okay. Were you in contact with your family during training?
During basic training, I made, besides letters, I probably wrote maybe six letters the whole time I was there. I think I made one phone call, and that was on graduation day. We had, we got done about noon, and we had to be back at the barracks by six, or by nine that night. And I called my dad, and my mom, who's in Illinois, and my mom in California, and my brother. And that was about the only phone calls I made.
Okay. Did you get any leave after basic training?
No, after basic training, we went directly to AIT at Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland. And we took they called it the Christmas Exodus. That was a 2 week leave during Christmas because the post was pretty much closed down for training. It was a training post. That was the first leave I had.
Okay. What was the advanced training like? How long did that last?
Well, advanced interview training, I got there on Thanksgiving Day. It was about 2 in the morning. And it was latter November, and I left there, I think it was on a Friday. We flew out of Dulles Airport in Virginia, and we got to Rhein-Main Air Base, Germany. It was on Easter Sunday, I remember that. So it was probably about 4 months, probably. And as a track vehicle repairman, our schooling was this basic automotive fundamentals of basically the internal combustion engine all the way to the gas turbine engine, which is like on the M1 A1 tank. That was the main battle tank and most popular advance at that time.
Okay.
And we did a lot of training on that and on Jeeps and Humvees, 113 personnel carriers, the Bradley fighting vehicle.
So you were cross trained on
in that MOS, yeah. We were basically what they call third shop. Let me try to recall that how it was worded. We're a third echelon, and what we did basically was remove and replace and repair major components on wheeled and track vehicles.
So
differentials, transmissions, engines,
okay,
injector pumps, things of that nature. We weren't so much like I think first or second shop that would be like a 63 Bravo where they did more maintenance like brakes, oil changes, things like that. We were more on the component side of the house.
The engine.
The engines. Yeah, transmissions, those things. Major okay. components.
All right. And that would be everything from, say, a Jeep or a Humvee
yeah.
to a Bradley fighting vehicle, which would be a smaller tank.
Well, that would be a small, that's not considered a tank. It's a track vehicle. It has a turret. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the size of the gun on it. And then in advanced in that training I did later, I worked on the, I went into the recovery school when I was over in Germany. And I worked on I think it was the 3 or 488 Hemet Wrecker. And I went for like 4 weeks up in Monteith, Germany.
Okay.
So I was on a recovery team that's advanced in my MLS.
Okay, now what do you mean by recovery?
That's retrieving vehicles that are stuck, mud, towing vehicles, things of that nature.
Okay. And
recovery.
So, right. So if, in the case of hostilities, you would be doing similar type work?
Yeah, well, in a combat environment, depending on what kind of combat environment you're in, we did a lot of training. We had, especially at night, with noise and light discipline. For example, we're out in Germany, we'd be pulling an engine, say, on a deuce and a half in a forest.
Mm-hmm.
There was no lights. We had our colored lenses on our flashlights. Somebody wanted to smoke under a poncho.
Mm-hmm.
And we trained in, when it rains, we train in some terrible weather, the mud, so you know how to combat. We train in our mop suits as our nuclear bombs, our chemical suits with our gas masks for several hours.
Mm-hmm.
We had training and put a lot of training, through basic training on that, in case we were in a chemical, nuclear biological environment.
Okay, all right, so there wasn't too much doubt in your mind that this was training for war and peacetime.
Yeah, they put it on all that, yeah.
Okay, going overseas, did you know where you were going and where in, you were posted in Germany and where in Germany, what was kind of the mood amongst the troops overseas, the civilian population, and you were sort of over there during the closing period of the Cold War,
yeah.
So kind of bring us, put us back there, if you could.
In early April of 1987, when I was still in advanced infantry training before we graduated, my orders came down from personnel, and I would say 7 out of 10, 70% of us were going to Germany. Maybe another 10 or 20% were stateside, and one would go to an alternative place, say Korea, Panama. The mass majority were still going to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We left out of Dulles Airport, and the thing is, I was 17, I turned 18 when I was in the military, and a lot of guys were 17, 18. And they couldn't wait to get to Germany. They said, we're going to drink Germany under the table, you know, heard all the stories, you know. And we arrived there at Rhein-Main Air Base, I believe it was on Easter Sunday. It was probably early, mid-morning. And it was raining, then it stopped raining. And we were at the air base for one night. And it was I was brand new, I was just out of high school and everything, I didn't know anything. It was a neat adventure, you didn't know what to expect, you know. And we got on a bus the next day. Some of us went to different areas. We went to Ansbach, Germany, the headquarters of the 1st Armored Division, Old Ironsides. That was the division I was in. And we spent a day and a half there. And then when we left there, we had orders to our unit, and I was being sent to the 3rd Support Battalion. It was the 3rd Bulldog Brigade. The 3rd Bulldog Brigade, we were 3rd Support Battalion, 1st Armored Division in Bamberg, Germany. And we got our first day of actually traveling on a train by ourselves. We went to the Bahnhof, which is a train station that means in German, and they mm-hmm. put us on a train, told us where to get off, and someone met us there. Mm-hmm. And my company was, most of them were in the field when I got there. Somebody met us at the train station, took us there.
Okay. Now, what part of Germany was that? Germany was still divided into East and West at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, we were in West Germany. We were in the northern part of Bavaria.
Okay, northern Bavaria.
We were actually, I think, yeah, it was southern, kind of more south-central. We were, for example, more east-southeast, and we were north of Nuremberg, probably about 30, 40 miles.
Okay, so it would have been like north of the Munich area.
Yeah, we're north of Munich, yeah.
A little bit, not
probably about 2.5 hours to Munich.
Okay. All right. So you weren't real close then to the kind of the east-west cutoff.
Yeah.
And, you know, what were your experiences like in terms of, you know, housing? You know, what was, you know, average day or week?
In Germany?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when we got to Germany, we were, some of these barracks, they were like big A-frames. They were tall. Some were like 4 or 5 stories. We were like on the third floor. And you can see that these barracks had been modified at one point because we didn't have open bays. That's per se, everybody's in one big room. Uh-huh. We were like anywhere between a 2 and an 8 man room when I was over in permanent duty.
So it was almost a little more like, say, a primitive college dorm.
Yeah, more primitive, yeah.
More than like a World War II era barracks.
Yeah, we didn't have that. We had that in part of AIT. We were in these A-frames. We had a community latrine in the middle.
Uh-huh.
But over in Germany, we weren't in a primitive. There were some places like that, but we were at, it was an old building, but you can see it was modified. And it was really green, really rainy. In the barracks, like I said, I was young. There was everybody from every walk of life. Some people moaned and groaned about everything all the time. Like anything, I guess. I was in a support unit, which, and our unit ended up becoming the 125th Support Battalion. They changed the name for whatever reason right after I got there. And we were on a, what do you call it? We were in the, I think, second or third platoon. We were on a contact team. There was like 5 contact teams. We supported different units within the 3rd Bulldog Brigade of the 1st Armored Division. Mm-hmm. And we supported the 3-3 armor. So basically, when they went to the field, we went to the field. If they go to war, we're going to go with them. We're not going to stay with our unit.
Okay, so you'd be assigned to an actual combat unit.
Yeah. We would be assigned to them. Like, when they went on field exercise, we went with them.
Okay.
And, our unit was divided. We had 3 companies. It was a very small unit. Uh-huh. We didn't even have 100 people in our company, in Bravo Company. That's what I was assigned to. And we had Alpha and Bravo, and headquarters was with Alpha. It was real small. They had maybe 60 people in that whole unit. And then Charlie Company was in a city called Monteith, which was near Nuremberg, and that was the medical unit.
Uh-huh.
And we did a little bit of training with them, but we never really saw them.
Okay, so now you were in Germany from like 87 to about...
April of 87, okay, until August of 1990. I got out 3 days after the invasion of Kuwait.
Okay. Now, what was going on in Germany? I mean, obviously, a lot of big things were going on at the time.
Well,
what was kind of your feeling and the talk of the place and that sort of thing?
Well, in 87, when I got there, I mean, everything was new. We did a 2-weekend processing. It was called ISIS in country, I can't remember what it was, in processing. And then my contact team, they were getting back from the field, and everybody started learning our job and everything. We would go to the field maybe 4.5 months out of the year, which wasn't very long. And the Berlin Wall didn't break until October of 89. And but there was still, I guess, a lot of hostility per se. We would go out into the field, and we'd go to some of these sites would be near the east-west German border, and we had like our armor company. We stayed in the rear, but they were out there patrolling it still, and by the Czechoslovakian side. And I really didn't feel there was a threat. I mean, anything was winding down. I mean, at that age, I mean, the reason is if they're going to let soldiers bring their families and kids over there at the government's expense, I mean, not that it wasn't a threat, but it wasn't that threatful. We're in Korea, that's a hardship tour no matter what. I don't even think they can even, I think maybe high-ranking officers or NCOs can bring their wives and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, pretty much where I was at, you know, people moaned and groaned, some people didn't. A lot of guys just wanted to go out and party, do what they wanted to do, you know, they couldn't wait to go out every night. But I mean, and overall it was just a neat experience being there, being in a country that was pulverized in 2 wars and see how it rebuilt itself, how America helped that, how England, how we and the French are over there and the Dutch and the Canadians, all as one team. I would say the German people overall were very nice. There was some Germans that didn't like Americans, and your haircut and uniform gave it away right there. But it was an experience. I was in Bamberg and I was on a bus taking it from the post into the downtown area. And because I loved history, and there was a church there, I think it was called St. Michael's, and there was a desk in there. his famous desk, and it was where Napoleon signed a war with Prussia, which was Russia at that time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he signed it in that cathedral, but the desk was there that he did. Anyway, I was on this bus, and I was reading all this stuff about that, and when an old person gets on a bus, you give your seat to the older person. They're real strict on there, and I gave my seat for this guy, and this guy sat down, and he put his arm on the rail, and he had a short sleeve shirt on, and he had a tattoo, and he had been in a concentration camp as a Jewish man. I believe that's what he was. I didn't ask him. Uh-huh. And he spoke English, and after I got up, he goes, sir, I think that's what he said. I think it was sir, a young man, goes, Ronald Reagan is a great president. And Reagan, he was still president then. Uh-huh. And that really felt good, you know. And overall, a lot of drinking going on, a lot of GIs over there getting DUIs. When a GI would get killed in a car wreck, they would take the car and they would put it in front of his unit or the battalion headquarters after they removed the bodies out of there. It was constant problems with drinking over there. Uh-huh. In the military, a lot of them, they could find everybody to post, but people were, that was probably the biggest problem versus a soldier fight or something.
Okay.
And just the experience of traveling and everything.
Okay. So generally speaking, there were people will die in service over there from DUIs or whatever.
DUIs. I mean, there was even some other things. There was, if you want me to tell you about them, there was a guy named Adeus. Yeah, I didn't know him. I'd seen him. I've met him, and he was an American Indian, and he was at the Bonhof one night, and he was drunk, and he was walking around a Saturday night by the railroad tracks, and he started climbing one of these electrical towers, and he got shocked, and he died. And this was a few months after I got there. And then at the end of the summer of September of 87, there's a guy named Falspool. This guy, well, he was a nice guy. He was Cajun. And it was kind of hard to understand him because of his language down there in Louisiana. And well, anyway, there was guys in the barracks when they run out of money or something, they tried to do what they call a poor man's drunk. They would drink Robitussin and do whatever they could to get a buzz. Well, this guy and some other guys were in the barracks, and they took these little butane canisters. They're similar to a propane canister. And the thing with a butane and propane canister is they're similar. They have a compression lip on there. And propane is 44 degrees below zero inside of a canister, where butane is 32 degrees. Anyway, they would take a nail and depress, and they would suck it and get high. Anyway, one day during the middle of the day, they came through. But they came out, got everybody, had a formation like at 3 o'clock, and they announced that this soldier had died. His lungs froze and his heart stopped. And they came through the barracks, went through everybody's room. They brought the dogs through for any kind of contraband. They did that a lot. We had constant drug testing in the middle of the night. We had a lot of alerts over there all the time, whether they're going to be real or not. That was another common thing, and people griped about that. Mm-hmm. People would be out, they'd really be drinking, they'd be out partying and stuff, and you get alerted at 2 in the morning, people are half drunk. It was a constant, you know, headache.
So it was a lot of readiness.
Yeah, a lot of readiness, yeah. They put a lot of emphasis on that.
What was your rank at the time?
When I was discharged?
Yeah, or throughout, I mean.
Oh, I made it to E4 Specialist 4.
Okay.
That's an E4, which would be if you're in that's pretty much non-combat, where if you're in a combat, you'd be a corporal.
A corporal,
yeah.
Okay.
But I was a specialist, that's what, same pay, but just less responsibility.
Okay. And in terms of unit casualties, I mean, you did see some people did die in service over there.
Yeah.
From stuff. Did that surprise you at all? That, you know, here you're in the Army, it's peacetime, and you're still having some people.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a shocking surprise. I mean, I was just 18 years old. I didn't know anything, and it's like, what the heck's going on here? And then a few months later, that after that one guy died at the train station, mm-hmm. the other guy died, and then you start seeing it. You know, is this like the norm around here?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I didn't know this guy, so it wasn't really personal. Mm-hmm. And you see guys from other units. And all I know is that there was, during the Gulf War, after I had gotten out, and my unit ended up going over there after I was discharged, there was one person in our unit, I don't remember his name, was killed. He was hit by a track vehicle. That's all I know.
Okay.
That was in my unit. I don't remember who it was or anything.
Okay. Now, you were in Germany when the wall came down, and what was the feeling amongst the Germans or the Americans about that time? I mean,
Okay, well, it was in October. I remember we had a formation that morning, and we, I don't know, it happened pretty early. It happened in Berlin. We were in the West, and I was watching something. It was on the Armed Forces Network in the day room right before our formation. It was after PT, after we had went to Chow. And we had our formation, and nothing was said about it then, but I heard something on there. Then they talked about it. Eastern Europe has just fallen. And they had walls that went along East and West Germany, Czechoslovakia, the Iron Curtain. Then you had where Berlin was separated. Well, right after that, that day, I think, within a couple of days, they started taking our links to the fence, and all the borders were open, and East Germans started coming over. And they had these little cars called Trabis, and they were little two-cylinder. And they really didn't know what living was. I mean, like what we had in the West, even in West Germany, I mean, they were lucky to get a car. It could take 5-6 years on a list, and they were driving over here, and they went across their the border, and their passport would be stamped, and they gave everybody, I think it was like 200 Deutschmarks to spend, any East German. And we saw some in Bamberg. We were maybe 30, 35 miles actually from the border. And, what I saw of it, they were just happy. People were honking horns. Some West Germans were kind of against it because the reason is when East Germany fell, when they were under communism, everybody was pretty much cared for. And now they're going to be pretty much a capitalistic country and everything, and there's going to be a big burden put on West Germans. And a lot of the West Germans, not all of them, that I saw, some that I even talked to, didn't like that. And they told us that, I don't know, maybe in November, we're probably going to be doing early outs. The whole formation of Europe is going to change, which, you know, they were just talking hot air there. They didn't know what was going on, and I took an early out. They were letting people get out early, and it's just being part of that history and defending it. Let's see what else.
Yeah, so you were kind of there almost for the final stage.
Yeah, I was there. I was there from 87 to 90, almost a year and 9 months after the walls came down.
And this was after 40 some years of occupation duty by U.S. forces, this was the end.
Yeah, this was it.
Okay, now, take us through the period when all of a sudden you go from Cold War ends, Gulf War starts.
Okay. Well, it was in August of, or actually it was July of 87. They were talking about early outs, and my discharge was in latter September. That's when I went to base training, 20-something of September 86 I went in. Said, we'd like to put in for early out if you have less than 6 months and get it approved. So I put it in, it was approved in latter July, and they said your ETS day will be like sometime in the first half of August.
Of
1990.
Okay, because I think you said 1987 initially. So you mean we're talking about 1990 here?
I'm leaving Germany.
Okay.
And I got out. It was 3 days after the invasion of Kuwait when Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait.
Okay.
And we weren't on any alerts or anything then. It was just didn't know what was going on.
Uh-huh.
So I left Germany, flew to Philadelphia, took a bus to Newark. Put in Newark, New Jersey, I think it was. Went to Fort Dix,
mm-hmm.
New Jersey. I was honorably discharged from there, got my last pay, got on a plane, and went back to California.
Okay.
And I was going to start school, college, on the GI Bill, college fund. But I said, I'll just wait until, I'll wait till summer or something. Anyway, in December, or actually January, it was after January, I remember it was after New Year's, I got a letter in the mail, a Western Union telegram,
okay.
Stating in the inactive ready reserve.
Uh-huh.
That means when you're in the military, say, for 4 years, you're 4 years inactive.
Uh-huh.
I've been recalled back to a minimum of 1 year of active duty service,
uh-huh.
And I believe I had 1 week to report to Aberdeen Proving Grounds, Maryland, where my AIT was.
Okay.
And it said, I had a plane voucher to go to the nearest airport. It said, bring your dog tags, any uniforms that you may have. And then I left within, I think it was like 5 days.
Okay. Well, was this pretty stunning for you? And
oh,
what
yeah.
What was going on your mind at that
yeah,
time?
Yeah, it's just like, you know, it was kind of shocking. I just got out of the Army after 4 years, and 5 months later, I'm back in. And anyway, I fly to Baltimore, get in a cab. We get to Aberdeen, and it was the biggest mess I've ever seen. There was so many, this is the biggest call-up of military troops in the history of the military. And just not inactive soldiers either. There were officers that were like an indefinite status and they're retired. There were even high-ranking NCOs that did 25, 30 years that were called back. Some of these guys were in the Korean War that were called back for this thing.
So they called in everybody.
They were calling in everybody. And a lot of guys, some guys have been out almost 4 years, you know, that were regular enlistees. They've been civilianized. Some guys already finished college. They had lives. And they're taking like a big pay cut, you know, and a lot of people were overweight, the long hair. And what it was when they got everything organized, we were in these old H-frame barracks. And the AIT people, they were in these new barracks. They were like 3-4-story, like apartments almost, you know, more dorm life. They had 2 and 3 man rooms. And people were mad about that. We sat around for about a week and a half in civilian clothing. They didn't know what to do with us. We had drill sergeants they brought over from the AIT units to us, and they were trying to treat us like raw recruits, but it didn't work. They go, you guys raise your hand, you're back in, deal with it. If you want to be treated like a newbie, that's what they call new soldiers. Mm-hmm. And we went out, we did some MOS training at night. We went into the classroom for whatever your MOS was to get back on that. There wasn't even enough bunks. They had to bring cots out. There was people, you know, they're civilians now. They brought the dogs through the barracks all the time. There was guys giving the MPs. It was just a big clutter. Uh-huh. But I can understand what's going on. We went out. Some guys, like I said, been out 4 years. Some guys haven't touched a rifle in 4 years. We went to the rifle range out there at Aberdeen. And when we went out there, they gave us an M16. They gave us, I think it was 40 rounds. We didn't zero our weapons. When you an old M16A1, when you go on a series, you go to a range where you zero your weapon for your sights. We didn't do that. Just gave us a rifle, shoot it, and that was it. Only training we had.
Okay, so zero the weapon for those of us that are civilians,
yeah.
means what are you practicing?
On your sights.
Okay.
Whether you're left-handed or right-handed, you have. Well, on the A2 now, if you have more of a thing, you had this little depressor, and you would have like this, it's been a long time, you have a paper target.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember exactly how it was, but you zero your weapon, you get your adjustment, so it's just right for you, that
uh-huh.
fits for you.
Uh-huh.
You know, so when you're firing, and we didn't even do that, because they weren't going to be issued a rifle, they just gave us 40 rounds, go out there and shoot targets, that was it.
Okay, so this was like, okay, take...
It's like a real crash course.
Fire a weapon for 40 times.
Yeah, shoot 40 rounds and that was it. We didn't clean our weapons or anything. And when we were over there, we went maybe a week and a half of actual training. The rest of the time we were on just detail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing police calls, picking up garbage, mm-hmm. doing whatever. They had some of it, you know, cleaning barracks. And then they orders started coming down. Oh, but there was a lot of generals and people walking around. We were like a science experiment.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because I never seen this. And it was also like a big reunion. Because I haven't seen some guys since they trained, or guys that went to in Germany. And one of our commanders, Captain Brochu, he was a captain, that was company commander. He was at Aberdeen. And this guy was a hardcore soldier. He was an enlisted man that went to college and then became an officer. And he was kind of old for a captain, probably in his late 30s. And he had a nice family, and there was about 10 of us that were from our old unit. We all got rounded up, and they had like a barbecue on Saturday. And then towards the end, orders were coming down. If you were going to go, you were either going to Germany, or if you're going to Germany, you're going to Germany. If not, you were replacing troops in the States. If you're going to Fort Jackson, Fort Benning, you were going over to the Gulf. And everything had already winded down. Pretty much they were putting out the oil wells. Anyway, I had a set of orders like every other day that I was going, then it got canceled, bing, 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 bing. Anyway, they send us to Fort Dix, which is about a 3.5-4-hour bus ride away,
mm-hmm.
to get our issue. Some of our issue. They didn't have it all at Aberdeen. So we got our fatigues, and some people got it at Avenue what they had left. So we just got regular fatigues, no deserts, and we got a million shots, did all that processing. And then we had to go get our haircuts. Mm-hmm. People were walking around in BDUs with ponytails. Army don't want to talk about that. You don't see that in the news, but it was a, one guy brought a dog with him, a little chihuahua.
So a big difference between the active duty personnel and out a little while.
Yeah.
Now, were the guys kind of watching the war on CNN? And
we were, when this happened, I was working in the Marriott Resort, and my mom called me on the phone. And it was right before my shift started. It was like at 3:34 in the afternoon. She goes, "You just got a letter in the mail. Go to war, go to jail." We just sing a song about that. She said that, you know. And she explained what it was. And so I told my boss, I said, "I'll finish out these next 3 days." I was watching on I think he had just broken out like a day before, 2 days before when the Scud started going off. I was on TV.
The ground war you're talking
about. Yeah, the ground war. And when the first thing started with America for real, whatever that was, not the Desert Shield. I'm talking about when the actual fighting started.
Desert Storm.
Yeah. First thing we saw on TV was Scuds, you know, missiles,
they were hitting Baghdad.
Yeah, hitting Baghdad.
Okay.
And I saw that like a couple nights before on TV, and then, anyway, when I got to Aberdeen a week later, you know, there was still some fighting going on or whatever it was. We're like, what's going on here, you know? And so some of us watched it, some guys who were just so mad. There was a soldier, I don't remember his name. He was actually over there during Desert Shield.
Okay.
He got shocked by an electrical wire somehow. He was missing three of his toes. He got recalled back into active duty, and he had to wait for a medical discharge. So he was there with us till March. This guy was on crutches, and he already been in the Army. I didn't even know about this. There was guys that got out in Germany that discharged there who married a German girl, whatever, and they had to fly back to the States. And another thing was, when we were there, it was towards the end, it was, people were just like, what's going on with this? Are we going? Are we staying? Nobody knew anything. That cadre, those are the people in charge of training, you know, in charge of the troops, like drill sergeants, your first sergeant. We probably had one person of leadership position, let's say a drill sergeant for maybe every 200-300 people. I mean, because everybody, the post was pretty much empty,
right,
except for us.
So what would be standard of ratio for a drill and
A drill instructor, for example, and for a platoon, you would usually have two drill sergeants. It might be 50 people, maybe 50, 60 people in a platoon.
All right.
But, I mean, they became what they call tax sergeants, as they call them.
Okay.
Or a platoon sergeant, these guys.
Okay.
So they took off the Smokey the Bear hat, and, uh-huh, you know. But, I mean, it was a constant, I gotta say this without swearing, hurry up and wait.
Yeah, hurry up.
Organized confusion, worse than it ever was because there's so many people.
Right.
I mean, we didn't go out with food or anything like that, but it was just like, what is going on here? And this is like, there's a big call to be going over here and nobody knows anything.
Did you ever get any sense of how many people actually got called up for?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there were people from all over the country at different posts, but for Aberdeen, we were beyond capacity because we were in these H-frame barracks and we had wall lockers. We were sharing wall lockers. They brought cots in there. They didn't even have enough bunks.
Any idea how many people were even in Aberdeen?
Oh, God, I mean, I don't know, I mean...
Tens of thousands?
No, not tens of thousands, maybe... I'd say probably at least... Maybe 2,000, 2,500, but it just depends where you were on this post. But for like in the Ordnance Corps, where you're in the Ordnance Corps, in that area where we were at, we also had Marines, they had Air Force Detachment, Navy. Those are real small, because they were learning things, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more people than normal. Because normally they would just have the AIT students at they had permanent party, mm-hmm, on that post, you know, people that, but most of your permanent party there were instructors, things of that, because it was a training post, per se. It wasn't like,
Okay, so this was all of a sudden a huge call up.
Yeah, people are just coming in, there's cabs, there's buses rolling in, it's just like, what's going on, everybody's checking in, like in a convention, you know?
So it's almost the logistics for World War III just about. Okay, talk about, you know, kind of things after service, and obviously, you know, you were kind of activated for the first Gulf War, and now there's another Gulf War, so, you know, kind of any added views on that at all, or
Okay, well, I'll kind of pick up when I left, Aberdeen Proving Ground in 1991 when I was discharged the second time.
Okay.
Well, we had to out process, like we in process, like everything. When we were there, I think I was there, it was sometime in March, it was less than 2 months.
Okay.
And they gave us a casual pay, which was like maybe $150. Well, anyway, we never got a paycheck. They were going to send that into the mail because they didn't know where the, because when you go to a permanent unit per se, they give you, you have what they call sure pay, a direct deposit like. So I remember after the first month there, they gave us another casual pay was in traveler's checks and maybe like another $150 and that was it. And it's like, well, some people need more money. Anyway, they sent us a check. People were mad about that. For example, say that you entered the military from Los Angeles. Well, anyway, the Department of the Army, whoever it was, they sent your mail grant to be called back up to there. Well, anyway, they had forwarded mail where you're at. Well, anyway, when plane tickets were coming down for us to get out of there, well, anyway, we didn't have any dress greens. They wanted us to be in dress greens. They sent us all the way back to Fort Dix again to get dress greens. We're in line with basic training troops. We got a dress green just so we could wear them for one day. And there was a guy that lived in, let's say, Vermont, for example. And he came from the Army in Georgia. Well, anyway, he had to fly back to Atlanta. They told him they wouldn't cut him a ticket to go there. He goes, well, I came from there. They forwarded it. He goes, well, that's where you came in the Army. That's where you got to fly back. Well, I don't live there. I'm not a resident anymore there. I moved to Vermont 3 years ago. So he had to pay for his own way home, you know, because the Army wouldn't do it.
He got discharged.
No, he was discharged at Aberdeen, but if he wanted to go home, he had to go home back to Georgia because that's where he came into the Army at.
Okay.
But he didn't live there anymore.
Went
to, actually, the letter went to his mother's house and she sent it to him,
uh-huh.
Told him and FedExed it, but and he actually got a ride. Vermont isn't that far from Maryland. He rode down with a buddy or his wife took him down. But when the plane ticket came back, you had to fill out where your whatever plane tickets were coming back, and they had him going to Atlanta. He goes, I don't need to go to Atlanta, I need to go to Vermont.
Okay. And
anyway, there was a lot of people. They were so mad. There were some guys wanted to re-enlist. They wouldn't let them re-enlist. They said, you have to be honorably discharged, then you can go to your recruiter and re-enlist. They go, you might not meet re-enlistment requirements. Well, if I can't meet re-enlistment requirements, then why are you calling me back? And I remember they said that specific to us. They had a thing. Anyway, when I got out, I said, well, are we going to be called up again? And we don't know what's going to happen down the road. And I pretty much just went on with my life. And and up to this point, when this thing started 2001, I knew my 4 years in active status was up. But Congress could always change something and call me back. So I was like, if it happens, it happens. About 20 pounds, way a little older now, so, you know. And, but I mean, I look at, you know, everything happens for a reason. And I look at it as a good experience, you know, because of the fact that, you know, people like me, we did volunteer and we were willing to come back. And I think that was important, but hopefully the military has learned from this. They'll be more organized in the future. If this does happen, I'm sure it's happened in this Gulf War. Some people have been recalled back, but I don't think at mass numbers like when we went through at Aberdeen Proving Ground.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a neat experience. You know, I don't regret it or anything. I mean, I was still young. I'm single. I have no kids and have anything. So it didn't really bother me. There was no pressure. I'm like, basically, I was on a vacation. Because when I got out of the military, I was still living with my folks for 5 months. So it's like, I'll be back whenever. But I was a little scared, you know. I don't know what was going on. You hear all the stories over there. And
okay. Okay. Anything else you'd like to put on the record before we halt the interview?
Well, I guess I appreciate this, you know, to be able to do this, you know. Maybe we can learn something from it, you know. It's nice, good to be heard.